did want to stop. As I said, a lot of these latter chapters of Exodus are saying, okay, so they did what God told them to do. It could have been summarized that way. Instead, it repeats a lot of what God told them. I do want to note in chapter 38, verse 21, it says, this is the inventory. It's actually not the full inventory of everything, but it gives us some detail. And actually, it does break down several of the things. It discusses all that they made following these commandments. And in verse 24, it says, all the gold that was used, all the work of the holy place, that is the gold of the offering, was 29 talents, 730 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary. Okay, 29 talents, that means nothing to me. There's a comparison. There's a lot more silver. In verse 25, the silver from those who were numbered was 100 talents and 1,700 shekels and 75 shekels. You know, and mentions a bika for each man. That's significant. Oh, yeah, in verse 29, the offering of the bronze was 70 talents, 2,400 shekels. Okay, I'm not a math whiz or any of that, but I found some sources that break this down and put it in modern terms. Scholars estimate that the tabernacle and all of its stuff, you know, I've got the term accoutrements, which I must have been waxing big in vocabulary, but that includes the Ark of the Covenant, the lampstand, the curtains, all the stuff. They say all of it together probably weighed about 10 tons because there's a lot of precious metals. Just think, the Levites would, this is a portable building that's 10 tons. So, it, you know, on a regular basis, it was going to be taken apart, dismantled, moved, and then set up again. So no wonder there's an entire tribe that's devoted to that. I've got a breakdown. How much gold? They think about 1 ton of gold, 2,000 pounds. Now, think of that. How many of you have a necklace or earrings or jewelry that's like, you know, a fraction of an ounce maybe? Or, you know, gold's pretty precious. About 3.5 tons of silver. That's a lot of silver. And about 2.5 tons of bronze. Bronze is not quite as valuable, but still, you know, high quality stuff. I think it's interesting that there was more silver than bronze. The bronze was mostly used for the outer, the court, that's, you know, the sort of screen that went on the outside around the tabernacle. The couplings and such inside were all silver, and then a lot of things were made of gold. I haven't come across anybody that tried to guess at how much the worth would be. And of course, the value of precious metals fluctuates day to day. But surely it was probably not only in the millions, but probably billions of dollars. And to think, a ton of gold, 3.5 tons of silver, 2.5 tons of bronze. I mean, and this is not counting for the highly valuable special cloth and things that were put into it. And this also reminds me, the Israelites gathered a lot of treasure from the Egyptians. These people had been slaves with nothing. And now they're building this elaborate building worth billions of dollars. That's, I don't know, it just makes me stop and wonder. Or maybe not wonder, but be amazed. I think it's really cool. But moving on, so that's the end of chapter 38. Chapter 39 is just another summary of Bezalel, Oholiab, and all the other dudes doing exactly what God said. I'm sure nobody back then called them dudes. And amazingly, it's a term I never use except in this room, it seems to come out of my mouth. But as God said, so they did. And jump to the end of the chapter, in chapter 40, or verse 43 of chapter 39, Moses looked over all the work. Okay, so Moses supervised it. And my suspicion is not that he waited until they're done, and then he comes and sees, okay, how is it? He's probably out there every day checking on their work, and they're saying, hey, Moses, how's this look? And he's probably saying, oh, that's really cool. Or he might say, no, that wing needs to be bent a little more this way if they're working on a cherubim. Or so Moses is there, it says, and he's checking. He says, indeed, they had done it as the Lord had commanded, just so they had done it. And Moses blessed them. And I don't know if Moses pronounced a blessing or what it means is, good job, guys. It's, you know, I imagine he was pretty happy. You know, I would hate to be the guy up on a mountain, God saying, you got to make this and it's going to look like this. And Moses is saying, I can't even talk very well, let alone make all this stuff. Well, don't worry about that. I got Bezalel and Oholiab and other people. Moses is probably coming down thinking, boy, I sure hope this works. You know, I got to make it look exactly like this. And then it happens. You know, it is a miracle. God gave them the talent, the ability, and somehow perhaps gave Moses the talent and ability to communicate them exactly what God wanted. And of course, God's involved every step of the way. God miraculously gives them the talents. And so God gets what he wants. And again, let's give the Israelites credit for, on this occasion, they did do what God wanted. And so it was done well. And now God is going to instruct Moses to set it all up. All the pieces are done. Chapter 40, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "On the first day of the first month, you shall set up the tabernacle of the tent of meeting." Now, I suspect Moses is going to have help, because if the whole thing together weighs 10 tons, you know, setting the things up requires many hands, but Moses is in charge. Interestingly, if you look across the page, verse 17, came to pass the first month of the second year. Okay, first month, second year. Well, what was the first month of the first year? I mean, we're getting a reference. What happened a year ago that day? Just remember when God was introducing the idea of the Passover to Moses, when he said, this month will be the beginning of months for you. And on the 10th day of the month, everybody set aside a lamb. And on 14th at sundown, you'll slaughter it. And so it's been a year since they were told they were going to leave Egypt. So that's it. Basically, a lot happened before then. And since then, of course, they did keep the Passover. They left Egypt, crossed the Red Sea, went, heard God speak from the mountain. You know, and we've got two 40-day and 40-night periods. So we don't know exactly, but say, you know, they spent about 9 months building this thing. About the equivalent of an academic year, which is kind of interesting to me. It's like if Moses comes down from the mountain the second time and says, "Everybody, let's get to work," it might be equivalent to when you all showed up at the end of August and we said, "Let's do ABC, let's all get to work." And then those 9 months later, near the end of May, we're going to set up for a graduation ceremony. It's kind of like them, after 9 months of hard work putting it all together, the tabernacle is raised and they're going to move on to the next phase. But in short, I usually just say it took them about a year to get all this done, and what a busy year they've had. So they do set it up. God instructs Moses to do this. Oh, yeah, also one thing, I'm glad I noticed this in my notes. We're going to go into Leviticus next, and we're going to see a lot of instruction about certain sacrifices and all that that have to be done at the tabernacle. Okay, it's been a year. What have they been doing in the meantime? And I don't know, there's speculation, perhaps they started doing the morning and the evening sacrifice, or perhaps not even that yet. Now, I'm just mentioning this by way of reminder. In Jeremiah in chapter 30-something, I don't remember the exact place and I don't have it written down, God mentioned that when he first spoke to the children of Israel, when he made his covenant, he didn't speak to them about sacrifices. You know, the sacrificial system is something separate that was added to the covenant. The covenant, in essence, was obey me, you know, follow my law, and I'll be your God and bless you. And of course, they turned out to be sinful people, so sacrifices were added. And I won't say just because they were sinful people. One of the things we're going to note in Leviticus is the sacrificial system was given as a way for a physical people without the Holy Spirit to approach God and worship him. So it's not just, well, you stupid sinners, you can't do it right, so here, kill an animal. You know, there was more to it than that. But the important, it goes to show that that was subordinate to obey God's law. And the sacrifices would be added, and they'd be, maybe I shouldn't say added and taken away. That's something that's in the covenant chart. I would say sacrifices have been, because remember, Abraham sacrificed, Cain and Abel sacrificed. We're going to put order and, you know, specific rules on the sacrifices for a time. Then, of course, we'll make the point that that all symbolizes Christ's sacrifice. But then we stop doing animal sacrifice. But I'll make the point, I think we do still sacrifice. And I think I mentioned this in Peter when I talked about what kind of sacrifices do Christians offer. Well, spiritual sacrifices. You know, we offer ourselves as a living sacrifice. We offer the sacrifice of praise, the fruit of our lips. So those types of things. So the mode of sacrifice changes, but sacrifice is a way of honoring and worshiping God, I'd say it is enduring. But this particular sacrifice that we call the ritual Levitical system is going to start after this tabernacle is built. And that would be about a year after they left Egypt. That was a long way of getting to that point, but I thought it was a point worth making. Well, God gives Moses instructions. And notice the word you. And verse 3, you shall put it on the Ark of the Testimony. Verse 4, you shall bring the table and arrange the things. Verse 5, you shall set the altar of gold of incense. Basically, God is telling Moses, you're in charge, you're doing this now. It's an important reason because if you go to verse 12, then you shall bring Aaron and his sons to the door of the tabernacle of meeting and wash them with water. You shall put the holy garments on Aaron and anoint him and consecrate him as priest. You shall bring his sons and clothe them. So until Aaron and his sons are consecrated as priests, Moses is doing the job. So Moses is like a temporary stand-in, and he's sanctified by God by special means. He spent 80 days with God. So Moses is doing the job until Aaron and his sons are put in the position. And Leviticus chapters 8 and 9 will have a thorough description. This is just a summary of what he's going to do. So we'll cover that when we get there. But Moses, in the meantime, is doing this. And in verse 16, it says, thus Moses did. Again, let's give Moses a pat on the back. He did what God said. He did according to all that the Lord commanded him. And it came to pass in the first month of the second year, on the first day of the month, the tabernacle was raised up. And it goes through and describes a lot of that stuff again. So he goes through and does all the stuff God said. So pardon me if I don't read through all of it. But something interesting happens. In verse 34, well, actually, let's at the end of verse 33, so Moses finished the work. It's all set up the way it's supposed to be. You can reference the charts and pictures. And then the cloud covered the tabernacle of meeting, and the glory of the Eternal filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tabernacle of meeting because the cloud rested above it. The glory of the Eternal filled the tabernacle. I've described this numerous times before. This is referring to what's called the Shekinah glory. God's presence literally comes in such a glorified state that human beings can't stand to be in there. It's implied that if they stayed, it would just kill them. So it's, you know, kind of interesting that way. God would repeat this exact same thing when the temple is dedicated that Solomon had built. That's in 1 Kings chapter 8, verses 10 and 11. So if you want that reference, 1 Kings 8, 10 and 11. You can put a finger here. I want to turn over to Leviticus chapter 9 because I think Leviticus 9 is describing another part of this. And I could be wrong. It could be, you know, I'm not sure exactly how, you know, some people would say that the sanctification of Aaron and his sons are done as the tabernacle is being set up, and this is the conclusion. But I like to associate what we're going to read here with the Shekinah glory, because it says in verse 23, this is at the end of their consecration, Moses and Aaron went into the tabernacle of meeting, and they came out and blessed the people. Then the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people, and fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the fat on the altar. And the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. The shout might have been a scream of terror, like, ah! But it seems that not only does the Shekinah glory come in, but God sends fire. They don't have to get flint and steel or do that thing with the bow to start a fire. God sends his fire and burns up the altar. He does that again when the temple is dedicated. You know, God doesn't send fire from heaven all the time. You know, he does it for Elijah, which was really cool. He burned up the altar itself and the stones. You know, he does it when David goes to make that sacrifice at the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. You know, and there's a few places, but this is something where God sends the fire. And we'll note when we go through Leviticus that he tells them, don't let that fire go out. That special fire. You keep it burning forever. So they add fuel to it. And a couple of Aaron's sons, try bringing in some other fire, because apparently they got a little bit lazy and they paid the price for it. So the important thing, though, is the Shekinah glory is there, God's presence. He graced it by being there himself. I guess I could ask the question, I think you know the answer, what is our parallel to this in modern times? We don't have a building, we don't have a fire that we always keep burning, and we don't have glory so great we can't go in the building. We don't have the Shekinah glory in a temple or a tabernacle. What do we have? We have the Holy Spirit in us. And we don't have to have a physical tent or building. We are the temple. I can give you some of the scriptural references, mostly in case you want to put them in your margin near this. But like 1 Corinthians 3, verse 16. 1 Corinthians 3, 16, where Paul wrote, "You are the temple of God. The Spirit dwells in you." Later in 1 Corinthians, also 6, verse 19, and in the book of, or the epistle to the Ephesians, if I want to say it more scholarly sounding, Ephesians 2, 21, and one we spent time in general epistles, 1 Peter 2, verse 5. I like that one. 1 Peter 2, 5 describes us as living stones built up together, a spiritual house or temple. So each one of us is like one stone that's part of the overall building. And Mr. Myers went over building the temple, right? In former prophets class. I know it seems like forever since you had form. Did he talk about how they carved the stones off-site and then put them together? I've always thought that's a great analogy for us. And he might have mentioned that, okay, if we're as individual stones in a temple, we're being prepared sort of off-site, so that when Christ returns, all the pieces can fit together without needing a tool or anything. So it hurts when you're being ground down or sanded and chiseled or whatever, but when the pieces all fit together, that's when it's a great thing. Okay, and let's finish up the chapter in the book, verse 36. Because when the Shekinah glory comes in, the cloud rested above it, and the glory of the eternal. So the pillar of cloud now is over the tabernacle. And the cloud was not, whenever the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle, the children of Israel would go onward in their journey. If the cloud was not taken up, they didn't journey till the day it was taken up. For the cloud of the eternal was above the tabernacle by day, and fire over it by night. So at night it turns into a really cool nightlight, goes from cloud to fire. And then in this morning, it turns back to cloud. In the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys. So for 40 years, that pillar is there. Everyone can see it. It's a daily, continual miracle. It started back in Exodus 13. That's when it first shows up, and they're following it. And we'll see it's described clearly in the book of Numbers in the scripture I don't remember, but it basically says, like it says here, when it went up, that's when they broke camp and followed it. And if it didn't go up for a day, a month, a year, they'd stay put. But when it went up, get your stuff ready, we're going to go. So God led them personally, and they saw that. That's one of the things in some ways it's kind of amazing because they saw it every day. And what else did they have every day? Well, 6 days a week, they could go out and get manna. God feeds them miraculously. And yet they still occasionally would rebel and sin. And we'll go through the accounts of that. That's why I think, that's bizarre. How do you see a miracle every single day and yet you still... So we want to keep that in mind for us because we live with a miracle every single day in a sense of having God's Spirit in us and making us able to understand His Word. So maybe I shouldn't be surprised that they saw this miracle and they still sinned, because it happens with us too. We have daily miracles, and yet we still sometimes take our eyes off of it and sin. Important thing is God will likewise still forgive us. Here's where I stop going through the scriptures and I'm preaching at you again. But okay, we're at the end of Exodus. Questions? Thoughts? Because as I said before we took our break, we're going to move right into Leviticus. Not that there isn't a proper break, but for testing purposes, I like putting these together. We get the tabernacle and its construction, and the golden calf incident is kind of stuck in there in the middle. And then we'll have, you know, Leviticus and all that entails there. And then we'll do, you know, multiple choice, true, false, whatever test, probably sometime in February. So how are we going to start Leviticus? You guys already know. What? We're going to do five W's. Okay. And actually, I don't have a lot on this, partly because Leviticus is in the middle of the Pentateuch. And the who is the same for every one of these books. Who wrote the book? Anyone who believes in divine inspiration of the Bible accepts that Moses was the author of Leviticus. Okay, so one thing I'll note is that God's direction is clearer than in most books. There is a phrase that appears 25 times in the book of Leviticus. And that phrase is, "The Lord said to Moses." So over and over and over again, the Lord said to Moses. So we get the feeling Moses is there. He's writing it down just as God told him. And I think that's true of the other books. But still, other passages of the Pentateuch are stories about what people did. And Moses didn't necessarily need to have God give him the exact wording. So anyways, take that for what it's worth. Let's talk about when. Now, before I tell you when I think it really was, it's worth noting that modern Bible critics, and they're the ones who don't think Moses wrote it. So these modern skeptics, we could call them, and this is commonplace. If you go to a seminary today, they'll teach you this. And that is the idea that the Leviticus was written during the Babylonian exile. So they would say that the guys who later would become Pharisees, you know, while the Israelites are way over here, after Nebuchadnezzar brought them there, that's when they made up all this stuff. And they said that it went way back to antiquity, but they're doing this to make up their story about how God made them special. I think that's a bunch of hogwash. I think God gave it to Moses when he said he did. So having said that, well, when was it written? Well, certainly after they left Egypt. He couldn't have written it before then. And before they entered the Promised Land. So we've got a broad window when we're pretty certain. It was sometime during the 40 years of wandering. Now, there's speculation that you could narrow it down. One thought is when Moses went up to the mount for the second 40 days and 40 nights, you know, it doesn't say a lot of what God told him then. Some people think maybe that's when God gave it to Moses. He already had all the instructions for building the tabernacle, so maybe then he gave him that, you know, after the golden calf incident. Maybe. Some think that it was written during that 9 months or so that Bezalel and Aholiab and the other guys were at work building the tabernacle. And Moses is going and checking on them. But along the way, maybe God's meeting with him and saying, okay, once this thing is done, you got to know how to do these sacrifices. So that's a strong maybe. All of these are only maybes, by the way. A more narrow window says that there's basically a one-week period when Aaron and his sons are being consecrated, and they have to stay at the tabernacle, and maybe God gave him at least the sacrificial instruction then. And I'm throwing these out. It's worth contemplating. And in the end, we just don't know. But it's, you know, like I said, we know it's at least sometime within the 40 years. Could it have been during the 40-day period, 1 week? Over the course of a year, you know, we can just guess, and I guess it doesn't make a difference. Moses got it sometime. We could also ask the where. Oh, I'm sorry, Charlie.
During the Babylonian exile, was that for?
That's when Bible skeptics who don't think that God inspired it, they say that the Jews made it up during that period. So I don't think that's true. But you could read that in a lot of textbooks. Yeah, Kayla? Okay, so, and I wanted you to be aware of it so that if you do come across it in some writings, it doesn't surprise you. Because, you know, there's a lot of people who study the Bible, who read Greek and Hebrew, and they believe that. You know, I don't think they're correct, obviously, because they also think that the Jews just made up this idea of what God was and how we should worship him. You know, I think God revealed these things. And that's something that gets into fundamentals of theology where, you know, you can look at it as people imagining who and what God should be and how we relate to him, or is it that God wanted us to understand and he told us certain things? And I'm getting off track. Okay, where We're not sure of the exact time, but I think probably on or at Mount Sinai. And Leviticus 7:38, since I have my glasses, I'll turn over there and see what it says. I've got Leviticus 7:38 in my notes twice here. And this is near the end of the instructions for sacrifice. In Leviticus 7:38, the Lord commanded Moses on Mount Sinai on the day when he commanded the children of Israel to offer their offerings to the Lord. So, and the word there, the Hebrew, matter of fact, I'm not sure if on or at is in the original Hebrew. A lot of times these articles, or no, that one's a preposition, apparently aren't always in the original Hebrew. And so, you know, it's obvious that a preposition needs to be there, but whether it's on or at depends on where you think Moses was when God gave him this. But I think it narrows it down enough. Okay, those were easy. What about the why and the what? And I'll say why is what I have in my notes first. Why is there the book of Leviticus? Well, let me stress what I think we could call the theme of the book. And you could say it in different ways, but if you wanted to sum it up in one word for what Leviticus is about, why it was written, was holiness. Holiness. It's the specific ways for a physical people and a nation to worship God. You know, and it to worship Him through a fairly detailed ritual system. So God, you know, is holy. They needed to treat Him as such. So He says, this is the way I want you to do it. You know, don't just make it up. Don't learn from the other nations how they do it. This is the way I want you to do it. So, and I'll get it, well, there's two broad sections, but I'll include, God also wanted them to know how to be a special and a different people themselves. So the book includes lifestyle instructions. So He wanted to teach them how to treat Him as holy, but also ways that they could keep themselves holy. And I have that, the theme I think is summarized well in chapter 11, verses 44 and 45. So Leviticus 11, 44 and 45, and I've got it abbreviated where He says, consecrate yourselves, and you shall be holy, for I am holy. So God is saying, consecrate yourselves, which means set yourselves apart for a holy purpose, and you're going to be holy because I, God, am holy. And the word that we often see, holy, is from the Hebrew. I've got it transliterated as a Q-A-D-A-S-H, Kadosh. But it means consecrated, it means dedicated, it means sanctified, of course it means holy. All these words are related. But something I've seen in what I've studied says the base or the root of this word basically means different. Different, not the normal. And that's where when God says, I want you to make a difference between the holy and the profane, it's make a difference. Holy is different. Now, it leaves unsaid necessarily why it's different, but our understanding is because it pertains to God. And we use the term in the church, we have for many years, we talk about something that's holy as being set aside for God's use. Have any of you heard that phrase? I think because, yeah, okay, it's still, I say I heard it a lot when I was young. I don't hear it as often, but obviously it's still in use. And it's accurate. It's not the all-encompassing definition, but it's a good working definition. It's set aside. It's different. It's made holy because it's God. Or belongs to God. You can make a reference in Ezekiel chapter 44, verse 23. He mentions there that the priests are supposed to make a difference between the holy and the profane. I think it appears elsewhere, but so that relates here. God, Leviticus is God's instruction so that the priests know how to make a difference between the holy and the profane. Ah, boy, I feel like I'm saying the same things over and over again. Yeah, Ezekiel 44, 23. That's where God talks about making a difference between the holy and the profane. And I'm pretty sure there's one or two other places in Ezekiel where it uses similar phrasing, but I don't have them written down. 22:26, thank you. Okay, let's briefly talk about what. Okay, and part of it, I'll give you the name, the word Leviticus is the name used in the Septuagint and Latin Vulgate, or the Latin from the Septuagint, and it means pertaining to the Levites. So the Levites, so this book is for the Levites, but to be, and of course, we're going to see in the narrative, well, we've already seen, remember, the Levites came to the side of Moses when they had to punish the people for the golden calf incident. And we'll go through the narrative, especially in the book of Numbers, where God will say, the Levites are going to be special. I'm going to take them instead of the firstborn of all the children of Israel. So the Levites will become dedicated. And you've seen that in all your studies so far. It's throughout the Old Testament. But it's not just to all the Levites. You could say specifically it's for a particular family within the Levites. Whose family? Aaron's family. You know, all the Aaron and his sons and all of his descendants were Levites, but not all Levites were priests. So the book really is more for the priests than for all Levites. But they work together. You know, the Levites, basically Aaron and his sons, the priests, are the bosses, and the Levites are the work crew. So it's good for them all to know the instruction. And I would say within the what, this pertains to the why, it has, I think, two broad sections. One being longer than the other. One, the first one, and we'll get into it fairly soon, is a description of various sacrifices and ritual practices for worshiping God. And that's a mouthful, but it's how to do the ritual, the practice that worships God. And what's the number one thing that's part of that? What practice did they do to worship God? Now, sacrifices. So you could say it's about how to sacrifice. But it includes other things. There's washings, there's the burning incense, there's maintaining the lampstand. So that's why I like to broaden it beyond sacrifice, the ritual system. And the priests conduct that. That's one important section. But the other section that covers more space in the book of Leviticus, I describe as rules for living. Rules for all the people of how to be a holy people. And that includes things like what to eat and not to eat. What days are holy and what days aren't holy. Who can you marry? Who shouldn't you marry? How do you maintain your health? You know, all these things are part of your special people. I want you to be different than the others. The health includes, you know, ritual washings. There's sacrifices, but there's the quarantine of people, of buildings, of clothes. You know, it's important to God, and it's going to benefit the people. Okay, you guys with me on this? Some of it can seem sort of tedious. Okay, one thing I want to say this because I get caught up in all these rituals, it's how to worship God. We want to remember, and we never want to forget, which is saying the same thing twice in two different ways. The sacrificial system was always a symbol of Christ and the sacrifice that he would be for them and was for us. And that's mentioned in the book of Hebrews. Specifically, Hebrews chapter 10 goes into detail. In my notes, I've got Hebrews 10, 1 through 4, and then Hebrews 10, 10, 11, and 12. But much of, matter of fact, I would say in general, and I think Mr. Myers will probably say it in a similar way, that a lot of what the book of Hebrews is about would be explaining to the Jewish people that you don't need that temple anymore. You know, the temple's fine and good, but guess what? The Romans are going to come and destroy it pretty soon. And you don't need those sacrifices because that was all about representing the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, the real and true sacrifice. And the reason I want to mention it here is that wasn't an afterthought. It wasn't a matter of, oh, the Babylonians destroyed the temple. Now what do we do? Well, maybe we could get the Son of God to stand in and he'll be a sacrifice. You know, it was never like that. You know, the animal sacrifices and all the ritual were always symbolic of the true spiritual, of Christ's sacrifice, the one true sacrifice. And remember in Hebrews it says he gave him sacrifice once for all mankind. And we'll see other elements in it, like, you know, the incense burned that we see as being representative of the prayers of the saints, and the holy oil that's used in anointing, representing the Holy Spirit. And so one thing I'll say is I won't take every element of the sacrifices and say this symbolizes this, and because partly I'd probably get some of it wrong, and some of it is mere guesswork. But I will say, as a whole, the sacrificial system was symbolic of the spiritual sacrifice or the spiritual worship of Jesus Christ, and the Father. You remember Christ, actually, I believe it was when he was at the well of Shechem and the woman came and he asked her to draw him some water. And she said, "What are you talking to me for? You're a Jew and I'm a Samaritan." Well, if you knew who you was talking to you, you'd ask me for water. He goes on for this, and one of the things he tells her is the Father is seeking people to worship him in spirit and in truth. And I reference the story to get to the point that the true worship of God is in spirit and in truth. All the stuff we're going to read in Leviticus wasn't illegitimate, but it was symbolic to represent the real worship in spirit and truth. We can do that because of God's Holy Spirit in us. God gave them this because he wasn't making the Holy Spirit widely available. Yes?
In general.
Sure.
When Jesus says that you Samaritans don't know who you worship because salvation is of the Jews, that just meant that since Jesus was from the line of Judah, he brings salvation. That's typically what he meant, right?
I think it also meant that God had revealed things to the Jewish people and before them to the Israelites in general.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
One of the things we want to keep in mind, and it fits in at the end of former prophets, I might mention, when the Israelites were taken away by the Assyrians, remember, they moved other people in, and you might have already covered this, and those people said, "The wild animals are eating us and all this. Send one of the priests from the nation of Israel to teach us how to worship this local God." So that's the ancestors of the Samaritans aren't even Israelites, even though they were taught that they were Israelites, and they started making that claim. But they never had any of the true worship. That they sent priests from the Israelites who did what? They taught them how to worship golden calves. They had, they'd been doing this false religion since the time of Jeroboam. So when they sent a priest from Israel to teach them how to worship the God of the land, a false priest came and taught them idolatry. And so when Jesus is talking to one of their descendants, he's saying, "You don't know what you're worshiping." They didn't get it because they'd been taught falsehood for generations. So I think partly what he said related to that. But it also the fact that God revealed this to the Jews, and yes, he, the Savior, was descended from David. He was Jewish. I love relating all the different stories, but it gets me off track of what we're doing here. With that as an introduction, let's start to talk about sacrifices. I've got a handout about the sacrifices because we're going to buzz through the first seven chapters, not in 10 minutes by any means, but fairly quickly. But let me give you some overview. And one of the things I often say, there's considerable detail given. And, and in the language, is the original Hebrew, there's questions for scholars of certain things that are written in Hebrew. How do we interpret this? Do we have it correct here? And in some ways that doesn't, I am going to pass this out. That way you'll have it. This is front and back. There's two different charts breaking up types of sacrifices. And that's basically because as scholars go through this, some people have said regarding the sacrifices, there are different categories. Some say as few as five, some say as many as eight. And I've seen different charts with different numbers and breaking them down differently. That's why I gave you two different ones. And I'm not saying that either or both of these are correct or incorrect. These are scholars' ideas of how to take what's in Leviticus 1 through 7 and categorize them. Okay, they seem to refer to, I would say, two very broad types of sacrifice. And this isn't in the chart. But in a broad sense, one type of offering a sacrifice was meant to pay the penalty for sin. So you sinned, you bring an animal and spill its blood as payment for that sin. Okay, and we often think that way, right? That's what sacrifice was all about. Less often do we think of the second category, but it's also detailed and there's probably more text given to describe that. And these were offerings in order to worship God. So one is saying, "God, please forgive me, there's atonement." Another one is, "God, you're all right. I love you." And these are sometimes referred to as being a sweet aroma to God. Smells good. Okay, so, and we'll look at some of which is which. In general, most sacrifices for sin, the people didn't get to eat any of it. like a burnt offering, all of it's burned up. And there's also called what's called sin offerings, where part is burned and part is given to the priest for him to eat, but if I'm the sinner, I don't get to eat it. But there are peace offerings and thank offerings that I get to offer, and a little bit of it's burned up, and the priest eats some, and me and my family eat all of it. Those are the yay, God, you're all right sacrifices that are a sweet aroma. Do you understand? So there's a general difference, yes. And this is a broad categorization. No. Oh, is that in the chart? Okay, yeah, we don't believe in the doctrine of original sin. I copied these out of two different textbooks. So, yeah, don't take these charts. And matter of fact, I think the notation of the books they came out of is on there. So, yeah, we don't believe in sacrifice for original sin because we don't believe that we're born tainted by the sin of Adam. So disregard, like I said, this is just a scholarly categorization according to their beliefs. So, yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out because it's been a while since I've looked at these. Okay, so I've got one other note I wrote in. You can tell I'm speaking in broad terms, and I always like to give the disclaimer. We're going to talk about sacrifices at a pretty low freshman level. Not like, if this were grad school for Leviticus, we'd be bringing in animals, and I'd give you knives, and we'd start, you know. But I'm not qualified to do that. So I've read through this, and I think they knew what God meant, but I don't read it and feel qualified to go out and take these instructions and put them into practice. So I think there might have been some oral tradition and other things informing Aaron and his sons as they did this. So, and we don't need to know. You know, we're not going to offer this anyways. We have the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. But I just want you to be aware, you know, I'm not going to get into the details of they slit this vein and they cut this piece and, you know, but I will mention I've had enough experience at meat cutting to know that it's hard work. You know, I worked at Fuddruckers for a year. I don't know, you guys, huh? Yeah, it's a burger place where they actually grind the hamburger there in the restaurant. So they get these big, they call them four quarters. One fourth of a cow comes in. I get to take it off the hook and carve it up and kind of neat stuff. You get blood all over you. Well, red stuff on your apron. And even that was nothing near taking a whole animal and gutting it. Some of you guys do deer hunting, right? I haven't gutted a deer out in the woods, but I understand it's hard, messy work. Okay, so the Levites and the priests are doing hard, messy work. And I'll just mention in passing, that's part of when Christ, talking about the Sabbath with the Pharisees, says the Levites profane the Sabbath and they're not guilty. He meant that they are doing work, and we're supposed to rest on the Sabbath, but some work to accomplish the sacrifices was required as worship. We translate that today as like a pastor doing a circuit, you know, driving 400 miles sometimes. That's at the long end, but speaking two sermons, counseling people, it's kind of a bit of work, but they're not guilty because it's, you know, we call it Levitical work as a catchphrase, sort of. Yeah, Charlie?
Like doing things, like physical things around the church, like pulling out, because we had like a little like shack area, and we had to pull everything out because it was used for a Sunday church where we do services. Oh. And I felt like, I'm like, am I breaking the Sabbath?
Oh, yeah.
When I first started, and I'm like, I started thinking about it, I'm like, this is servant work and stuff like that.
So exactly. It's yeah, we're lucky here. We have a hall, you know, but, you know, we set up chairs, move tables, do, you know, a lot of congregations have to do a lot of that. Yes, Danny?
I was just curious how you answer the question that someone might pose as to why we would believe that the sacrificial system will be in place again, because it's not something that we take part in right now, and Christ will have returned.
Oh, you mean like in reference in places in prophecy where it seems to indicate?
Yes.
Yeah, well, let me give you two speculations, and they're only speculations. In my mind, the jury is out. I'm curious to see, but one is that we know some of these sacrifices are not for sin, which I mentioned. Some are sweet aromas to God, peace offerings and thank offerings. Some people have proposed that it's that kind of offering. And that makes perfect sense, and sort of. Maybe I shouldn't say perfect sense, but it's something I could wrap my mind around. Some people have suggested that God might make the Israelites do sacrifice, in part because they never did do it right in the past, which, but some have said, and I like this idea, but I'm not sold on it. But, you know, during the millennium, sin is going to become infrequent. I think it'll take a long time. You know, it's 1,000 years, so it's not like year two, no more sin. But eventually, sin is going to be infrequent, so people won't suffer from sin. I've heard the speculation that God might have the sacrifices done to remind people that there is a price, a penalty to be paid for sin. Sin brings death. Sin is bad. It causes suffering, and there's a high price for it. You guys don't know much about that because you hardly ever sin, but I want you to know what sin causes. Look at the blood, you know. I can wrap my mind around that, but both of those are guesses. Because there's no place, Ezekiel just doesn't say, why build a new temple and why do these sacrifices? And there might be others. I don't know if that helps at all. And it's funny, I was planning on covering this in Ezekiel and Major Prophets later. Those are the two main reasons that I've heard that I think are worth keeping in mind. There are probably others, and maybe I'll come across some others later that I would add to my list. But in the long run, I'm going to be happy to ask Jesus Christ that question when he shows up. And it could be that we misunderstand the prophecies. Maybe it won't be at all that there'll be sacrifice. Okay, enough of that for now.